Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
With the Conservative campaign struggling, is the party looking for a little magic from a wizard from Oz? The Tories are bringing in a hired gun from down under, with political strategist Linton Crosby coming in to help them get back on track. We take a look at what Crosby brings to the table and speak with a Conservative strategist about reports of internal struggles in the blue team.
The Liberal Party announced some big policy proposals this week on employment insurance, affordable housing, and public transit. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is on our show as we go toe-to-toe with him over his campaign promises.
It's halfway through the longest election campaign in modern history, and so far it's been a tough three-way battle with many controversial issues already popping up in the race. But how does it stack up against past campaigns in our country? We speak with the author of Fights of Our Lives, John Duffy.
And from tweets to Facebook posts, previous social media comments from candidates and campaign staff have been causing some headaches in the war rooms of all parties. The McLean's panel talks about campaigning in the digital age.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Well, it's no secret, this is not the election campaign the Conservatives had been hoping for. Since the writ was dropped on August 2nd, the party has been taken off message many times to deal with issues like the revelations in the trial for Senator Mike Duffy, the economy slipping into recession in the first quarter, the Syrian refugee crisis, and even a candidate caught urinating into a mug.
On top of this, it appears there may be trouble in the Conservative ranks. There are reports about senior Tories being unhappy with the way Conservative campaign manager Jenny Byrne has been running the show. Before we talk about the internal issues, though, we'll look at how the Conservatives plan to deal with their struggling campaign.
Well, Aaron, what else do you do when your team is having a bad streak and you still need to pull off a win? You call in a ringer. As McLean's magazine first reported, the Tories have hired Linton Crosby to come in and help rejuvenate the campaign. Crosby is an Australian political strategist known as the Wizard from Oz and has traveled the globe working for mainly conservative campaigns. Leader Stephen Harper was asked about Crosby's hiring but refused to comment.
As you know, I do not discuss internal campaign matters. Our campaign is focused on the issues that we're talking about publicly that Canadians care about.
So, Aaron, you prepared a profile from McLeans.ca. What can you tell me about this election guru from down under? Who is Linton Crosby?
Like a lot of political strategists, he has almost a mythic telling of who he is and sort of a legendary status, I guess. He's originally an Australian political strategist. He worked for the Australian Liberal Party, which is actually their conservative party. He is tremendously well thought of. He's sort of celebrated for his understanding of polling and of voters and his insistence on message discipline. Very well regarded.
He has not just worked in Australia. He's been sent off to work in other campaigns. Where else has he worked, and how effective has he been?
Yeah, so he was mostly involved in different capacities with four national elections in Australia for the Australian Liberal Party, all of which they won. He then moves to Britain, and first he's involved in a British Conservative campaign that doesn't go that well. They lose. But he then recovers and twice gets Boris Johnson elected mayor of London, and then comes in and runs the Conservative campaign for David Cameron, which just got elected with a majority, a fairly surprising majority.
Now, it seems that there have been some controversies around his methods as well. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's hard to always kind of parse these things from afar. There are sort of complaints about how tough those campaigns that they've run have been. One of the early Australian campaigns was associated with a fairly major controversy over refugees that were trying to get to Australia. It's tough to kind of parse exactly whether this is just sort of what happens in politics, that they're fairly tough campaigns, and the people who end up losing them inevitably complain that those campaigns are tough. I'm not sure how much I would read into it, and I think I'd actually be surprised if you see much of a change in tone in the Conservative campaign. As much as I think it's been interesting in one way that the Liberals and the NDP have tried to capitalize and say that this marks some kind of nasty turn in the Conservative campaign.
Thanks, Aaron. And as we mentioned earlier, more and more reports are surfacing this week claiming that all is not well in the Conservative campaign team. and that's part of the reason why Crosby is being called in. Now, some senior Tories have been complaining to the media that campaign manager Jenny Byrne doesn't have a good handle on directing this race. In fact, we found out this week that Byrne, who had been flying on the leaders' tour with Stephen Harper, was sent back to Ottawa to start doing her job from the centralized war room.
To respond to the reports of internal struggles in the Conservative camp and give us an insider's view of some of the key players, Maclean's senior writer Laura Payton speaks with Michelle Austin. Austin is a senior advisor at Summa Strategies, but has been a longtime Conservative who worked in war rooms for Preston Manning, Stockwell Day, and Stephen Harper. She left government in 2013.
Can you tell us what's going on in the Conservative Party war room?
Well, I think you've had no doubt you've had a tough couple of days. I think that things are turning around, have turned around here at the end of the week. But they were shaken by a number of issues that were, I think, unexpected. The Syrian refugee crisis was an unexpected issue because the Conservatives very carefully planned most of their campaign. And of course, the candidate selection business was tough, but I have to say that every party strategist will tell you that they go through that. So there were some bumps on the road for this past week, and the polls at the beginning of the week didn't look that great. But, you know, politics is like the weather. If you don't like that poll, just wait another day and you'll get a new one. So it feels like at the end of the week, things are coming back together.
So you mentioned you think the campaign is already having a better time of it. What else can the Conservatives do to get back on track? They're kind of used to having control during the election.
Yes, yeah, indeed they are. And I think this is going to be a bit of a different campaign for the Conservatives because they are going to have to not just run on their record, but I think clearly what they have to do is start painting a pretty negative picture of the NDP. In fact, almost go catastrophic, because I think that Conservative supporters need to hear that. If an NDP government or even a Liberal government came in, that things would be really, really bad. They need to sort of be the Avengers Age of Ultron. It's the end of the world if the NDP comes to power, and so we need to take action. So I think that they need to do a good job of focusing on the NDP, not something they've done in the past. But the other thing that they really have to do is get out the Conservative vote. Clearly, with a tough week, your vote tends to soften. There's still a lot of time in the campaign, and I think the Conservatives are going to appeal directly to their supporters and firm that up and make sure that come Election Day, which is still a while away, the Conservatives come out in force to support Stephen Harper.
Now, we heard at the end of the week that the Conservatives have been working or are bringing on this Australian strategist, Lynton Crosby. Depends on who you're reading, I think. But what does somebody like that bring to a campaign that they couldn't get out of their existing base in Canada?
Well, they bring a fresh set of eyes and a wonderful resume with a lot of experience. So this isn't really new to the Conservatives, having an exchange back and forth with the Australian Conservative movement. Stephen Harper has done that for many years, and there's been some exchanges with John Howard's team. So this isn't new for them, but what will be nice will be to bring gray hairs experience that Lynton Crosby has running campaigns all over the world, and he'll bring a fresh set of eyes to the campaign and help them sort out what is important and what isn't. And I think that is going to be very, very helpful to the war room.
A lot of people maybe know the name Jenny Byrne if they follow politics carefully, but even for those of us in Ottawa, she's a bit of an unknown quantity. What is she like as a campaign strategist?
We're in a great spot here, speaking as a woman. You have three women who are in charge of each three campaigns. Jenny Byrne has been around the Conservative movement for a very long time. She started as an intern in Preston Manning's office. So, I mean, I think her strengths are that she's extremely devoted to the cause and to the leader. She's a very tough taskmaster. I think that story has come out many times this week, that she doesn't put up with any baloney. And she has lots and lots of experience. But at the same time, when you're a tough taskmaster, you're not a people person. I think one of the things that has happened is that when the campaign had a rough spot, people were looking for someone to blame, and they pointed to Jenny, maybe because they've had a negative past history with her. And so I think that she suffered under the fact that she's not necessarily known as a people person, and so people were happy to lay some blame on her. So I think that the other problem the war room has is that it's fairly young, and so as we talked about, the addition of Lynton Crosby is going to be welcomed.
With Mr. Crosby joining the campaign, you talked about the need to maybe go negative on the NDP to get conservative supporters coming out. Mr. Crosby's been, you know, when people talk about him, they talk about dog whistle politics, sending a signal to a party's base. That's something that he did in Australia for John Howard. Is that something that he's going to be working on in Canada?
Oh, I hope so, Laura. I really do. Because, you know, we've spent a lot of time as a conservative talking about Justin Trudeau. I think now is the time, clearly, to start talking about Tom Mulcair and these policies that he has in terms of what he's promising versus how much it will cost. Because give it to the NDP. They've sat back and they've watched, you know, when the Conservatives have had troubles, and they haven't really put anything in the window that people can talk about. They've talked about how the Conservatives have had trouble, but they've not necessarily put out what it is the NDP is going to do and how it's going to be costed. They keep talking about it, but they haven't done it yet. I think that the base, the traditional conservative supporter who is usually sort of older, who has oftentimes a large family, they want to know how the NDP's policies on child care, for instance, or on spending are going to impact their bottom line. And I think one of the most important things the campaign is going to have to do is paint a very clear picture for conservative supporters about how much an NDP government is going to cost them. And Lynton Crosby is a very well-positioned individual to help the campaign do that.
That was Laura Payton speaking with Michelle Austin, a former conservative strategist who is now a senior advisor at Summa Strategies. We were also able to speak with conservative candidate Aaron O'Toole about this issue, but were unable to squeeze it into the show. To listen to that interview, head to macleans.ca.
Still to come on the show, we go toe-to-toe with Liberal Justin Trudeau over his campaign promises. We compare this election campaign with races from the past, and the Macleans panel weighs in on the troubles with the Tories and how social media posts have created problems on the campaign trail. Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Macleans Magazine.
Coming up on the show, halfway through the campaign, we see how the 42nd election stacks up against campaigns from the past, and the Macleans panel weighs in on the troubles with the Tories, and we look at how Facebook and Twitter are causing problems for all three main parties. But first,
this week, the Liberals unveiled several key policy promises that they hope will sway voters as the Grits see a bump in the polls. On Tuesday, leader Justin Trudeau promised changes to improve Canada's employment insurance system. He wants to cut the current rate, although his rate will be higher than what the Conservatives set out in their spring budget. Trudeau says the extra cash that will be collected will be reinvested in the system to boost skills training and slash the waiting period for benefits from 2 weeks to one. On Wednesday, the party made affordable housing commitments to help with the construction of rental housing for middle and low-income Canadians. Then on Thursday, it was a promise of $20 billion for more transit infrastructure over the next decade.
Now, to pay for all these commitments, the Grits have already said they will be posting deficits for the next 3 years. I was able to speak with Justin Trudeau, who called me after a campaign event in Toronto on Wednesday where he had been announcing his housing strategy. I asked the Liberal leader about a couple of his latest promises and some other issues that have popped up in this campaign.
So, Justin, I'll start off with the announcement that you made today. As part of your infrastructure plan, you want to give incentives to build affordable housing, mainly rental units. You're also going to be reviewing, though, home prices, home price increases in major cities like Vancouver and Toronto. But what can you actually do about that as a federal government?
One of the things that people are worried about is the increasing cost of home ownership, particularly in some of our major urban centers. And quite frankly, the federal government needs, as it needs to on so many different levels, needs to be a better partner to provinces and municipalities with the challenges their citizens are facing. And I think a federal government that actually, first of all, collects appropriate data and actually understands what people are challenged with in their daily lives and in their hopes and dreams is going to be able to help with municipalities and provinces in addressing various challenges like these.
But where's the teeth? What exactly can you do as a federal government to try and deal with these higher prices?
Well, because we're talking about very specific jurisdictions with very particular challenges, the most important thing that the federal government can do is actually sit down with municipal leaders and provincial premiers to talk about the challenges they're facing in their particular areas. And that's something that I've committed to being a much better partner on than this current government that doesn't like to talk to other levels of government.
Now, we'll look at your EI plan that you announced yesterday. The Conservatives say that your employment insurance is, plan is basically a payroll tax increase. And I guess the question is, how is it not? In the last budget, the Conservatives had already set out that in 2017, they'd lower the premium to $1.49 per $100 of insurable earnings. Your announcement would set the premium at $1.65 instead, which means come 2017, that would be an increase, and Canadians would not be taking home as much money as they had thought they would, as was promised in the budget.
This is a great example of the Conservatives not being able to do basic math. Premiums are right now at $1.88. We are going to lower them to $1.65 as of January 1st, 2017. Now, as for the Conservatives' promises, well, in their most recent budget, they promised that they'd be balancing the budget, and they've failed to do that. So I don't know why anyone would believe anything they say about what they might do 2 years from now. We are reducing premiums and increasing the effectiveness of EI in helping people getting back to work, and that's exactly what Canadians need right across the country.
But why not lower it? Why do you need to keep that $2 billion?
The fact is we need to put that money towards the people who need help getting through tough times where they've been laid off. That's what EI is all about. And Mr. Harper's cuts have actually made it much harder for people who paid into the system to get the benefits for which they are entitled. And that's wrong. People who pay their benefits should be receiving what they paid into and what they deserve, and not having to be stuck going to food banks and stressed out about whether or not they're going to be able to feed their kids in the coming weeks.
Paul Martin, when he was finance minister, called payroll taxes a cancer on the economy. So how do you square that with voters when they see that you could be saving, you know, $2 billion and all of that, but you're deciding to keep it while your opponents say that they would cut it?
Canadians expect their government to make sure that we're helping the people who need the help and growing the economy. And that's exactly what we're committed to do, not just with our historic investments into infrastructure that are going to create jobs while the others are focusing on cuts, but by lowering payroll taxes, by lowering EI premiums from $1.88 to $1.65, at the same time as we make sure that the people who need help are getting the help that they paid into, because they're not getting it under Stephen Harper. That's what Canadians expect from their government.
On the Syrian refugee crisis, you and your party want to bring in 25,000 refugees as soon as possible. How exactly do you plan to fast-track the system? What sort of checks and balances might be sacrificed as a result of this process? Because, I mean, ISIS has shown in terms of security concerns that they've been willing to go to great lengths to get access to countries, like even faking their own deaths.
Well, we've seen that Canada has been able in the past and will continue to be able to address the very real security concerns as we bring people over. We did that in the years following the Vietnam War, where there were tremendous concerns about that. And what was missing from this particular situation is merely political will. Mr. Harper does not think we need to do more to help vulnerable people around the world. We know that we can, and quite frankly, Canadians want us to do more. That doesn't mean sacrificing security, and the fact that Mr. Harper is talking about it that way is just showing that he's trying to find any excuse to not do what Canadians feel that we should be doing, which is help more people.
You were raised Catholic. What do you think of the tweets from the NDP's director of communications who said, you know, stop calling the misogynist, homophobic, child-molesting Catholic Church a moral authority, and then basically replied to a tweet from the Pope saying, go F yourself. Do you think Sean Dern has to go?
I think that kind of language and intolerance is, quite frankly, irresponsible from anyone. Mr. Mulcair needs to make very, very clear that kind of language is unacceptable within his organization, and it's more than just an apology that is needed.
Do you think he should be fired?
An individual who said hateful things like that would no longer be a part of my organization.
On balancing the budget, you know, the NDP has said that it's about not burdening our future generations with debt and ensuring that we can afford important public programs into the future. Isn't it important for a government to live within its means?
Absolutely. But at this point, when interest rates are low, it's a time to invest in jobs and growth. Mr. Harper's failure over the past 10 years is on not creating enough growth. And Mr. Mulcair's decision to cut billions of dollars from our economy when we're in recession, when Canadians need help, is what's going to burden future generations. We will balance the budget in 2019, and we'll do it by investing in the kind of growth needed to get our country back on track after 10 years of Mr. Harper's failure. I, for the life of me, can't understand why Mr. Mulcair would choose not to help Canadians who need help and instead choose cuts and to go back on his promises on health care, on transit, and on other things.
You've pledged in the past to have a cabinet that's 50% women, but only a third of your candidates are actually women. So how are you going to fill that cabinet?
We have extraordinary women running for us right across this country, and I look forward to showing that women are needed in positions of power, and I certainly hope that after people see how effective a cabinet with a gender parity in it is, we're going to draw even more women into politics in subsequent elections.
What if you don't have a lot of them voted in as MPs? Then you face a few women. How could you actually reach that parity level?
I am entirely confident that the extraordinary women that we have running for us right across this country will make excellent cabinet ministers.
That was Liberal leader Justin Trudeau speaking about a variety of issues and promises from the campaign.
Still to come, we take a look at how this election campaign compares to political fights from our past, and the Maclean's panel looks at the troubles in the Conservative camp and how social media is causing headaches for campaigns.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Maclean's panel talks about how previous social media posts are creating headaches for each party's campaign. But first,
the 2015 election campaign is rather unique. Not only is it the longest campaign in modern Canadian history, but we've also seen a debate days after the writ drop, a trial for a suspended senator that saw some of the Prime Minister's closest advisors take the stand, a technical recession being announced weeks in, and a refugee crisis that has put foreign policy in the spotlight. It's definitely been a fascinating race. But how does it stack up against previous elections in Canadian history? To find out, I spoke with John Duffy, the author of Fights of Our Lives, a book that chronicles the key elections that have helped shape our country. So, John, we're at the midway point of this campaign, this rather long campaign. Where would you say this one looks like it's set to rank in terms of the elections, the fights that we've had in the past?
I think it could rank very, very highly, and it's on course to become a great Canadian election. There are three criteria that I wrote in Fights of Our Lives 12 years ago that constitute a great election. The first does the election deal with a great national issue or set of issues? The second is, does the election move structural change in Canadian politics? And the third criterion, of course, was, is it a good fight? Is it compelling? Is it fun to watch? Does it get the juices going? And I think on all three scores, campaign 2015 is shaping up to be a great one.
How much of that is the fact that it's well, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the first sort of real three-way fight that we've had?
That's a big factor, Aaron. And that almost by definition qualifies this election as a great national one. Now, you know, it's possible to say that 2011 was a great three-way fight, but nobody knew it until about two-thirds of the way through when Jack Layton, may he rest in peace, made it into a fantastic three-way fight and nearly put the Liberals out for the count. This one, you know, features a couple of things that are making it unusually important in terms of the structure of Canadian politics. First of all, it is a three-way fight. Poll after poll shows that, you know, the parties are essentially bunched up neck and neck, fighting it out riding by riding, region by region, street by street, house by house. Because of that, you were likely to see coming out of this a reshaping of politics. At a minimum, you're looking at now Canadian politics having transitioned from a two-and-a-half-party system to a three-party system. That looks like it's likely to occur at the end of the piece, although we'll see what happens when the votes are counted. The second thing that is so important here is the regional pattern. And this is quite fascinating to me, and I think to people who look at the big picture on these things. The NDP are now absolutely dominant in the province of Quebec. And at this point in the campaign, they are continuing, it appears, to sort of grow and gather the consensus of Quebec, particularly Francophone Quebec, in their favor. The other pillar of the NDP coalition in Canada is British Columbia. Now, we have never seen before in Canadian politics a national party fundamentally based in British Columbia and Quebec. That's an extremely unusual alignment. We've never had it before. And it suggests an approach to politics that's actually a tectonic shift, given the agendas of, you know, voters in those two provinces, which are a little bit different from those in, you know, the traditional heartlands of Canadian politics in Ontario and, you know, the island of Montreal and Atlantic Canada and Winnipeg and that kind of thing. So there's some big stuff happening out there.
How would you compare Stephen Harper's situation to previous incumbents? You know, it's obviously it's tough to win four terms in a row, but, you know, where does he sort of fit in the historical context?
Right now he's in very, very tough territory. I would say almost unprecedented. I mean, we don't have polling back before the 1940s in this country, but to see an incumbent government below 30% at the 10-year mark, midway through a campaign, you know, this is like one of those sort of football situations where the commentator says, well, we've never seen, you know, in playoff football, in the Super Bowl, no team has ever come back, you know, overcome a 10-point deficit in the fourth quarter, blah, blah. So the odds are long. The other way to measure this is when people say, oh, but there's a whole campaign to go. Somebody smart pointed out to me the other day, no government has ever willingly called an election, you know, with 5 weeks to go. No government has ever called a 5-week election in this position in public opinion unless they were constitutionally obligated to do so. So right now, Stephen Harper, if it was a normal length campaign, wouldn't call this election. Nobody would at 30%. That's the kind of territory the government's in right now. However, 5 weeks is a very long time. And there's a lot of room for the Conservatives to let a pivot happen. There's things in the Prime Minister's body language that make me wonder if that isn't what he's trying to make happen. This is paying off of Paul Wells' really good campaign trail article that was published, I think, a couple of days ago. So it's interesting. You can't rule the Conservatives out. You never can. Not under Harper. They're really good. They're really, really good.
In terms of the one last thing I wanted to ask about was the issues and you know, the policies that are at stake here, because you mentioned it earlier. And the common complaint, and it's been made in this campaign, is that, you know, issues aren't being discussed or they aren't being discussed very well. And I feel like that complaint gets made in every election. But, you know, how does this one, in terms of the ideas, the issues that are at stake, in the way they're being debated or not debated, how do we put that in perspective?
It's a great question, Aaron. And I think, first of all, yes, you're right. It's always cool by the pool to say that there's no content in these elections. Sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less. And I'll tell you why. The Harper government is so different from any other Canadian government in the past. John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker coined the phrase the Laurentian consensus to describe previous Canadian governments as being essentially of the same cloth. There's a fair bit of truth to that. The thesis can be overstated, but there's a fair bit of truth that, that there was more continuity than discontinuity in the rotation of governments in Canada up until Harper. Harper is a discontinuity moment. To use an Ontario example, it's a lot like Harris. It's a different coalition. It's a different outlook. It's different. That means that when a government like Harper's is fighting for its life, as they are right now, something basic about the approach of the federal government to Canadian affairs and to the future course of the country, something basic is on the line. That doesn't come down to any one single issue. It hasn't yet anyway. But you put together their approach to climate change, the Conservatives' approach to taxation, the Conservatives' approach to deficit, their approach to a laissez-faire industrial strategy, their approach to refugee policy, their approach to defense and security. It all feels pretty coherently of the clear movement Conservative small c right. And the other two parties have grouped fairly clearly and coherently around the progressive center. That's where they're trying to be. That represents a very clear choice of direction, clearer even than what's revealed in the particular positionings on things like the deficit, stimulative spending on infrastructure, or even refugee policy and security in the Middle East. So I think Canadians at a gut level understand there's a basic question of approach, and one outcome or another will be very different depending on the fate of the Conservatives.
That was John Duffy, author of Fights of Our Lives. To listen to the full interview with Duffy, head to macleans.ca.
Coming up after the break, the Macleans panel dissects the struggles in the Conservative campaign and discusses the digital problems for all parties as tweets and Facebook posts come back to haunt candidates and staffers. It's now time for the Macleans panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by Macleans Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and Macleans Political Editor Paul Wells. Thanks very much for joining me here, guys.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right, let's talk about the troubles or struggles in the Conservative camp. We'll start off with that, getting Linton Crosby in to try and help out the campaign team to get everything back in order and try and get the campaign back on track. They're struggling a little bit in the polls right now. From a regular voter's point of view, they see the Conservatives bringing in an outsider, somebody from abroad, to try and help them get their campaign going in the direction they want. Paul, it looks bad. How bad is it?
Well, it's pretty bad in the sense that the trend in the polls is downward for the Conservatives slowly and has been, and they're unlikely to win, and it's almost impossible to imagine them holding their majority. And that's not the outcome that Stephen Harper wants. So he reaches to someone who's actually a longtime acquaintance of Canadian Conservatives, Linton Crosby, an Australian who was instrumental in the election of Boris Johnson as mayor of London and of David Cameron's surprising majority re-election earlier this year in the UK. Jason Kenney, in particular, has known Crosby for several years, and there have been visits. There's a kind of an Anglosphere family of conservative parties in New Zealand, Australia, the UK, and Canada. They don't spend much time with American conservatives because the presidential system there is not very comparable to a parliamentary system, and because U.S. Republicans are just seen as too extreme in the Canadian context. But among those other countries, there are regular visits and exchanges of best ideas, and you'll see a New Zealand ad popping up as a Canadian conservative ad a couple years later and things like that. Linton Crosby moves in those circles, and the Conservatives have tapped him to try and right their ship.
So, John, where will he bring the Conservative campaign?
I've spoken with a couple of conservatives on background in the last couple of days just to try to get a sense of that, and they're insisting he's not going to bring them any place very new. You know, they're not looking to him for a radical change of direction. They're looking for him for a sharpening of the messaging on the same messages that they think they can win with. So, for example, we've seen just in the last day an emphasis on security and fighting terrorism, which I think is pretty clearly meant to be a response to people who said, well, they're not compassionate enough about refugees. They're saying, no, we're about as compassionate as you need to be, but we're very vigilant about threats to Canada's security. I think they think that's an issue that they can that they can win with, or at least win the people who are winnable for them, right? That the base and people who might drift into the conservative camp might not be, as Paul suggests, enough for them to dream about a majority gain. But if they're going to eke out a minority, that's where it's going to be. This guy comes with that kind of messaging as part of his normal arsenal of messages that he delivers. So maybe what we're going to see here is less a change of direction and more a sharpening of tone or focus.
Paul, I think anybody who's worked in any office scenario across the country knows that when some big name comes in, the others in the work environment might be happy, some might be resentful. They might not like the change that they're seeing. You have a small inner circle of people that are supposed to be trusted, and now an outsider's coming in. How do you think this is going to play out inside the war room?
Well, it's plainly playing out with some leaks that Harper's not used to in his shop, and some resentment back and forth. There have been some in the Toronto Star, for instance. There were a rare case of conservatives bad-mouthing other conservatives for talking about this stuff. But upheaval in Harper campaigns is not unheard of. In 2011, Dimitri Soutis was making so many enemies on the campaign a media bus that they parachuted in a consultant from Toronto named Jason Leader to be nice to reporters. And then at the end of that campaign, Harper fired his major strategist, Patrick Muttart, for some skullduggery in the Sun newspapers. In 2005, he was plainly headed for defeat until he switched two of his senior helpers, Ian Brody and Doug Finley, gave each of them the other guy's job and told them to do them better. And that led to the breakthrough election victory of 2006. Harper often changes things up. And the surprise would have been if he didn't, given how badly things have been going.
Paul, you might have a thought on this. One thing I noticed about the conservative circle, the Harper circle, is they've known each other well for a long time now, including Jenny Byrne, who's at the top of the peak there now, pinnacle there now. In the old Krachan operation, they always brought in John Ray, right, who was not part of the day-to-day running of things in Ottawa for the Liberals. So when he came in to run the campaign, there was this outside who had an aura, right? This is the guy coming in to run the campaign now. There was no sense of him being one of us. He wasn't a day-to-day routine familiar figure who people would develop those natural tensions or, you know, little abrasion points with, right? And I always thought that was a kind of a genius thing, because you'd hear people, even very veteran liberals, say, well, John Ray says do it this way, as though it was obvious that if John Ray said it, because he'd come in to be the campaign dude, you know, that it had to be taken seriously. There really wasn't a figure like that in conservative circles now. Maybe Doug Finley, in a way, was like that in his time, but they're a band of people who've worked together for a long time. There isn't a sort of august figure from outside who can sort of be seen as standing a bit apart from that.
Well, maybe a different perspective on that. For the longest time, it seemed that there was nobody indispensable in Harper's circle. The chief of staff, the communications director, the campaign strategist that he came in with in 2006 were all long gone by 2011. But since then, it seems like he has relied increasingly on sure values, that he's got a smaller number of people that have been with him forever, who he protects even when it seems not very helpful to him to protect them. Ray Novak is the clearest example. But, I mean, different strokes for different folks. There's a bunch of ways to win an election. And Harper's actually tried a few different ones, and it looks like he's looking around for yet another way to win this one.
All right, now I want to focus on digital campaigning for a minute, because we saw this week a number of candidates and staff members from every party facing scrutiny over previous tweets or Facebook posts for the Conservatives. We had somebody making sexist comments on Facebook for the NDP, the Director of Communications for Thomas Mulcair, sending out anti-Catholic tweets from 2 years ago. For the Liberals, there's a candidate on Facebook who tried to say that marijuana was no harm to children and could decrease domestic violence. So, and she was later dropped as a candidate. So every party has these problems and they're facing it. Paul, we'll start with you. Is it fair to point at, you know, Facebook posts or tweets from 2 years ago and hold that against some people involved in politics, whether it be candidates or staffers?
Well, it helps explain why I will never run for public office. This gets back to a big change, again, that the Harper campaign made between the 2004 defeat and the 2006 victory. 2004, he was dragged down by a bunch of ridiculous things that some of his candidates made. And in 2006, it was more of a zero-tolerance policy. So, you know, there was a Germont Grewal, an incumbent MP from British Columbia, who was thought that he had maybe flirted with jumping ship to the Liberals. On the first day of the campaign, he was kicked out. The problem is, the 2006 campaign was before Twitter, it was before YouTube, it was before Facebook, before any of these technologies took off. And it's just like a really easy now to find something embarrassing that someone said a long time ago. So more than a dozen candidates have from various parties have met that fate. And until we get thicker skins about this, until we say to ourselves, you know, just about everyone has said something stupid, and we're the first generation in history where everything stupid we ever did is still on the internet. Then you're going to see these like pretty massive culls of candidates. Each case, the merits of keeping the candidate or getting rid of them can be debated, but the campaign leaderships have plainly decided they don't have 3 days to litigate this.
That's right.
They need to shut it down right now and get on to some other kind of headline than these embarrassing headlines.
It's not fair to say, Paul. It's a question of how much time do we have? How valuable is this person? Do we want to spend 48 hours defending them or putting it in? How big is it going to be? Isn't there also a difference in the type of indiscretion, though? If somebody blows off steam, uses bad language online, that's one thing. If somebody frames an argument, you know, the Liberal candidate from BC talked about the Canadian Cancer Foundation as being a front for big pharma. That seems to me less like saying something without really thinking about it, and more like that sounds like something she had thought about, you know? And I find that much more troubling than someone, you know, swearing, saying something nasty. When I think, gee, that's someone who's thought that through and said something that's a little nutty. You know, that would be more to me a firing offense no matter what.
And that's the way Justin Trudeau addressed the issue when he was asked about it. He said the views that she was putting out there were not his views and not the views of his party. And then later in the day, she's dropped as a candidate, although he had another candidate who said that he was on a drunken binge and
right.
posted things that he later regretted. After apologizing, he's still a candidate.
And if that's true, and I guess you just have to accept it's probably true that somebody was loaded and did stupid things on social media, yeah, I wouldn't want to hang someone to dry on that. If someone's thought something through and said it, that you have to take seriously.
All right. And I guess in you know, 5 or 10 years, are we going to still be dealing with this, though? Because you're going to have a lot of kids nowadays, 17 years old, probably posting stuff. They're not thinking about it. When they get into politics at 26, 27, whatever age it may be, there's going to be a lot of ammo, I guess, if this is the way it's going to go.
So either you're going to get a communal thicker skin about all these things, and people are going to say, you know, boys and girls will be boys and girls and we have to move on. Or you're going to get a very quirky and fundamentally boring segment of the Canadian population being the last people who are qualified for public office. Like, just as very senior lawyers and judges in the U.S. legal system at a certain point in their career start to vet every word they say and every opinion they say against the possibility that it could come up in their Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And everyone in Canada who's interested in politics is suddenly going to get off Facebook, get off Twitter, and wrap themselves in cellophane against the day when they finally run for office.
Bubble boy candidates, I guess.
Yeah, you know, that's what we need, blander politicians. Because when you look around, they're such an exciting and fizzy group right now, right? Like, oh my Lord.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate it. McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode. Don't forget to check out McLean's Magazine's other podcasts, The Thrill, about pop culture, and Bibliopod, about books.
But for more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.